Welcome to Book Waves. I'm Richard Walensky. My guest is Adam Hazlett, whose novel is Union Atlantic, also the author of short story collection You Are Not a Stranger Here. Adam Hazlett is an attorney. He's written several pieces of nonfiction. This is the first novel, and you've been working on it now for 5 years. The book itself concerns financial wheelings and dealings in the early part of this century, which means 5 years ago, and I understand that you were working on the book when everything crashed.
Well, I finished it the week that Lehman collapsed in September 2008. I think, like everybody, I was surprised. I mean, it took a while for us to see how grave it was going to be, but I suppose the thing that I'd been paying attention to for a while was the idea that this financial architecture was not that stable, and that we'd had crises before, whether it was the Asian financial crisis or the currency crisis or the collapse of long-term capital management. And so there were these things that were going on, and what had interested me when I read about those things is that when it came down to it, at the most important moments, it wasn't actually about the law, it wasn't actually about regulation, it was about a bunch of guys in a room who knew each other for a long time making decisions. And that's some of what I wanted to dramatize in the book.
Your short story collection is all of these very personal stories that seem to focus in on grief and longing. And there's an undercurrent of grief and longing with all four major characters in this book as well. But this book lives more in the real world than You Are Not a Stranger Here.
Yeah. I mean, I think a lot of that is the difference in genre. The kind of novels I like to read have a sort of social scope to them that's telling you something about what it's like to be alive in the world today. And I wanted to get some of that scope inside. So it's definitely, you're right, that it's a more outward-turned book.
What started you on the thought? I understand there was something about the Federal Reserve.
Yeah, the Federal Reserve. I mean, I started reading a book about 10 years ago by William Grider, who I'm sure you're familiar with, The Secrets of the Temple. And it was a wonderful account of the Fed, nonfiction account. And it got me thinking about how these large, generally anonymous organizations and agencies control things in a very abstract way based on numbers, and yet the consequences of those abstract decisions are very important in everyday life. And I just thought it would be interesting to put a guy in that character, write someone who has that point of view and that sort of God's eye view of the economy.
At that point, were you still thinking short story? Were you thinking...
No, I think that I wasn't going to write an entire book just from that one point of view, and so it implied that there would be other characters and it would be a broader, bigger piece. It would be a novel.
At what point did the character Henry emerge?
He was the first person who I wrote about almost 10 years ago, and then I put it aside. I was finishing the stories in law school, and then when I came to get back to it, actually the next character I came to was Evelyn Jones, who's a woman who works in the bank, though at the time I was just writing the scene of her brother's funeral, so it wasn't even her in the bank. The way I go about it is always individual characters, and then the plot emerges by me trying to push them together.
So that could have been the beginning of a short story at some point, because Evelyn Jones, in those initial pages with Evelyn Jones, is the first time we meet her. We haven't seen her before.
Yeah.
It emerges who she is, but it didn't have to emerge.
No, that's true. I always start with characters, in a sense, on their own. Even if they're surrounded by other people, I'm in their head, really. That's the first thing that fascinates me, and then they sort of eventually, I get them to meet the other people in the book, in a sense, and things move forward from there.
The first story in You Are Not a Stranger Here, which is titled Notes to My Biographer, we're in the voice of a crazy man. And that's kind of in a way where each of these chapters begins, inside the head of somebody who may or may not be crazy.
Yeah. No, I think that's right. I mean, I start always with the rhythm of the language. I'm trying to find the rhythm that goes with each character, because I feel like in order to really convince, there's got to be a kind of musical argument that runs beneath just the surface of the facts you're getting. Like, otherwise, you could just write a synopsis of the plot and call it a day. So I do try to find in each character a rhythm that I can follow through. So that makes sense.
At the beginning, before you put it aside, what did you actually have of Henry?
I had a scene just that now only a piece of remains 3/4 of the way through the book where he's standing in his office at the Federal Reserve looking down at these people leaving work, and he's sort of imagining how they fit into the broader picture of, you know, what their credit card charges are going to go and the supermarket inventories and all that kind of stuff. And it was just really, again, a moment of knowing who he was based on what he would think when he looked out the window.
So then, Adam Haseley, you finish the short story collection. It gets published to very good reviews. You're in law school. Where is your brain in terms of wanting to be a writer, wanting to be a lawyer? Are you bouncing back and forth?
Well, I had been writing for a number of years before I went to law school. The writing was going to continue one way or the other.
You'd been to Iowa.
I'd been to Iowa, yeah, just before going to law school. And so then the question was just, would I be doing it with a full-time job as a lawyer? And, you know, as it turned out, the fork in the road came after law school, and I haven't been practicing as a lawyer. I've been working more or less full-time on this book.
You get out of law school and you're sitting there and you've got Henry. How is the story moving from there? Does his sister Charlotte suddenly pop up out of the blue? Where does she come from?
She came up as a character before I knew what her relations with the others would be. She's a very solitary woman, retired history teacher, someone who believes in sort of art and literature and philosophy in that kind of religious, fervent way. She's got all these ideas circling in her head, and I came up with the idea that she would be spoken back to by these two dogs she lives with, one of the voice of Cotton Mather, one of the voice of Malcolm X. That became another big sort of generative force, and she became a main character.
At this point, does the fictional town of Findon, a wealthy suburb of Boston, is that when this town emerges?
Certainly she sets it up pretty starkly because of her attitudes to how the town's treated her and her history there. So, yeah, it definitely is part of it.
There are four main characters, and the protagonist, or seeming protagonist, though it's hard to say who's the protagonist of the book, a man named Doug Fanning comes into existence. Now, I understand that you've said that he's one of those characters who kind of pushes their way into the forefront, and that seemed to happen here. How did that happen?
Well, I was writing about Jeffrey Holland, who's the head of Union Atlantic, the bank of the title, because once I was involved with a Fed, it implied a bank that would be regulated that I'd be writing about. And the more I wrote about Jeffrey Holland, the more I thought, you know, he's a CEO. His interior life, it just wasn't that interesting. He's a politician, basically. He's a corporate politician. He's the ultimate pragmatist. He would, you know, turn on a dime. So the person that was more interesting to me was the sort of the Roger Skillings rather than the Ken Lay, the person with their fingers on the machinery inside the bank. So I was writing a scene of Jeffrey Holland, and Doug Fanning, his number two, came in, and I suddenly was writing more interesting paragraphs about Doug Fanning than I was about Jeffrey Holland.
And at what point did you decide to set the prologue on the USS Vincennes, which is a true story that this ship was in the Gulf and shot down an Iranian jetliner claiming that it was a missile or something?
Yeah, that it was a jet fighter, yeah. And also claiming that we were not in Iranian territorial waters, which we were. You know, it's funny. I mean, 5 years is a long time, and so you go down a lot of different roads. And I kind of became interested in that incident and wrote that entire chapter or section, not sure where it would fit in. And then, you know, I thought to myself, this could be Doug. It comes as the first thing you read now, but it certainly didn't come that way chronologically.
In essence, it sets up Doug because everything Doug is seen in that initial chapter.
Yeah, yeah. He's someone who is more amoral than immoral, and he has a kind of self-interest that he's very aware of. To me, the thing that I realized at some point when I was going along was that, you know, two of the forces that we've been living with so much in the last 10 years are militarism and a kind of hyper-capitalism, and it seems to me that the emotion that underlies both of those is anger, a kind of male anger. And I feel like Doug is someone who who channels that emotion, but he knows he's doing it. So there's a kind of self-consciousness. He can watch himself use that emotion.
There's another quote I have from you, that you wanted to show a masculine form of desire that's more about power than object choice.
Yeah.
And at this point, suddenly you've got a 17-year-old boy named Nate.
Yeah, there's a high school senior who's recently lost his father, and he, falling behind in school, comes for tutoring to this retired school teacher, Charlotte Graves, and he's sort of bewitched by her in a way, but this house that's been built right next to Charlotte also kind of attracts him, and he can't even tell if anybody lives there, but he goes in, sort of trespasses, investigates, and Doug comes upon him in the house. He pretty much right away, in that kind of adolescent, over-the-top way, just has this huge crush on Doug.
He reminded me, in a way, of the character in The Beginnings of Grief, the short story.
Yeah. You know, writers have preoccupations. Those scenes between Doug and Nate were some of the hardest to write for two different reasons. One was that I wanted to have a character in Doug. The reader could read about him having sex with another man and not at that moment think, ah, he's coming out. You know, the sort of the narrative we're used to of act equals identity, and therefore, you know, it's just a one-directional line, because Doug's choosing him because he's weak, not because he's male. And for Nate, it's on the one hand a little simpler. I mean, he's a gay kid, but he's attracted to a kind of masculinity which is sort of punishing. It's different for both of them, right? They come from totally different points of view. So, I mean, for Nate, in his naive adolescent way, kind of would like it to be. This guy seems this kind of like perfect guy to him. But it's certainly not a quote-unquote gay relationship for Doug. I think there's a way in which throughout, one of the parts of that I hope the reader gets is, without really wanting to see it too much, he's seeing a little bit of himself in Nate. There's a little bit of the doppelganger effect where he's interacting with his own younger self.
Adam Hazlett, one of the problems in dealing with a novel about finance, people like Paul Erdman had the same problem. How do you tell a story about money and credit and keep it interesting?
Yeah. No, it was a big challenge. I mean, the two things the Fed does are set interest rates and deal with financial crises, and I was not going to write a novel about interest rate policy. To me, you always write the book you want to read, and if you're curious about a world, you want to sort of be over the character's shoulder seeing what's happening, not get a lecture from a book about here's all this information you don't know. So to the extent possible, I was always trying to write about the experience of the guy as the head of the Fed or the banker just as he's moving through his world. And so I kind of learned the world that they were in by writing them as they moved through it. And then the reader, in a sense, hopefully learns about that world in process, not stopping and getting a lecture.
It seemed to me, as the book went on, the characters that we as readers identify with, perhaps it starts with Charlotte and Doug, but it finishes with Nate and Henry.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, no, I think that's right. I mean, there's something about Charlotte and Doug, though opposed, you know, in the plot and of very different values, share a kind of absolutism. They're both cling to their ideas and their viewpoints with a kind of almost violence. And Nate is a romantic and a little more malleable, and Henry is a pragmatist and therefore a little more malleable.
Do you know the story as a whole, even though you know how it's going to be told, or not at all?
There are two sort of strands. One is the sort of the banking plot, and the other is, you know, all these relationships that are going on alongside it. The banking thing, at least I knew that there was a bit of an arc to it. There was going to be, you know, a bank in trouble and so on. But how, you know, beyond that very schematic sense, I didn't know until it's really a matter of weaving together the parts that I've written that interest me and trying to make it into a whole.
Were there any characters that got jettisoned that are kind of sitting on the side waiting for stories now?
No. Well, I don't know if they're waiting for stories. I mean, there was certainly more on Evelyn, more on Jeffrey Holland, the head of the bank, more on his wife Glenda, but that just once I realized where the through line was, I needed to kind of keep it moving forward.
You're listening to an interview with Adam Hazlett, whose novel is Union Atlantic. The 4th of July party turns into slapstick.
There's an excess that I'm trying to get at there that I think befits the era that we just lived through. And it's the one scene in the book where pretty much every character is on stage.
Adam Hazlett, when you were writing the book, were you afraid that maybe no one would ever want to read it?
Sure. I mean, I think any novelist ought to worry about that through much of their writing. It took me a long time for it to quicken into something that I thought was worthwhile. But certainly, just even on the more topical sense, I thought, you know, who cares about the Fed, or this banking stuff seems a little obscure, and that problem was obviously solved by history.
I mentioned before that your short stories and this book deal with the parallel lines of grief and longing. What is it about Adam Hazlett that brings that out, or is it something that you don't even question because if you question it, you lose something?
Yeah. You know, I experienced grief in my own life, like a lot of us. I'm always interested in people's minds on their own. Like, when you're on your own, everybody's got a story, words flowing through their head when they're not with people. And I think if you stop to contemplate that, which is sort of what fiction does, instead of running through life like we all have to, for me, when I do that, I guess it's like staring at a Rorschach. I get to sadnesses or sort of lacuna in life, and where people feel something missing and feel a desire for something. And often, actually, what's happening in the stories and in this book, I think, is that people are seeking intimacy. They want to be closer to people, and they're trying to figure out how to do that. And they're better or worse at that. Doug's pretty bad at it. He can only really be with someone by exercising power. But they all want that.
It seemed to me that somehow you came closest with Nate, and I'm not sure why.
He was the last character to come into focus, and, you know, probably not coincidentally, because I feel like I had to give the most of myself to him, you know, biographically. So, you know, I think one dynamic of writing is the overcoming of shame, you know, I love books where you feel as though the writer's left some kind of blood on the floor at the end of the day. I certainly internally feel like I left some blood on the floor after I wrote this.
Well, literally, yeah. You did, yeah. In the beginning of Grief.
Yeah,
and you,
yeah,
did literally in Union Atlantic.
Yeah.
The scenes between them are very intense.
Yeah, yeah. One of the things that was in that story and then is in the book, too, is that if you take an emotional state, a kind of what Baldwin called a fanciful anguish, and then you make it material, then that drama can be very dynamic, because suddenly these things that are in a lot of our minds, if you act it out, if you dramatize it, it can kind of crackle.
Adam Hazlett, talked before about your origins as a writer. Had you always been interested in writing then?
Well, not always. I was dyslexic as a kid, so I didn't get started reading till later, and I didn't start writing fiction until I was in college. I'd sort of, you know, filled journals and stuff before that. But, yeah, I came to it in my, I guess, late teens, early 20s, and just have been doing it ever since.
Well, what was the first story that you got published, and how did that happen?
I think the first story was the one that is the first story in the book, The Notes to My Biographer. And that was right around the time I was leaving grad school that got published in Zoetrope.
And you kept writing at that point.
Yeah.
And where did Iowa come in?
I was there the 2 years before I went to law school, and I'd been the year before to the Provincetown Fine Arts Work Center. So I'd had sort of 3 years there in my mid to late 20s where I was, you know, writing pretty intensively, and that's where most of the first book got written.
In Iowa, they do focus on voice. I mean, that's been in talking with, with Marilyn Robinson, in talking with Ethan Kane, and what I've noticed in the short stories and in the novel is voice is always where you start and where you finish.
Yeah. It's interesting to hear you say that. I'm kind of happy that comes through. I mean, because the temptation, I think often, especially because of, you know, facts that have happened since I finished the book, is always just to talk about the plot and the, you know, the financial stuff. But it's finding that rhythm and that music for each character that then lets me sense of whether there's something that I think is true and worthwhile in each of these people to keep going with.
The actual story involving, the financial story involving wheelings and dealings in Japan, how much of that is factual?
That particular incident is invented. It's an invented bank. But the Japanese government does, or has at least, I don't know if they still do, engaged in these what they call price stability operations, where they unbeknownst to the market, buy up a lot of domestic Japanese stocks to prop the market up. And so the conceit here is that that's what's happened, and Union Atlantic has surreptitiously learned this is going to happen, so they kind of know the Japanese stock market's going to rise. So they make what they call a unidirectional bet, a kind of a naked bet on the rise of the Japanese market.
Did you have somebody vet this?
I didn't have anybody vet the whole thing. When I got to a point where I felt like I was reaching a little beyond what my knowledge was, then I would check in and see, if I got this right. And, I had a couple of people I could call about that.
And how about Henry's office at the Federal Reserve?
That I've peeked into. I've got a couple of friends who work at the Fed. And so, I saw the gold vault and I saw the boardroom and all that.
And the town of Findon itself, what is that town in real life?
It's an amalgam of two towns that I grew up in Massachusetts, one south of Boston near the Cape and the other west of Boston, sort of a combination of the two.
Well, there's an interrelationship there among the characters. Nate's best friend is Jeffrey Holland's son. Is that pretty typical for those areas, or was that kind of Dickensian on your part?
I knew actually one of my friends. One of my friends there, her father was the head of a bank, so that didn't seem like such a stretch. They're going to the same high school. It's not that big a place.
In a sense, every book is political, or at least social commentary. What do you think you're trying to get across here?
I think I want to get at a certain moral climate that we've been living in for quite a while now, but that's sort of intensifying in the last 10 years. There's a scene towards the end of the book, or two-thirds of the way through, where Doug is talking to Holland, his boss, and he says, things are changing. The whole compact between government, media, citizens, corporations, it's all changing. It's changing so fast that most people are attached to one form or another of how things used to be, and so they're very focused on whether that part's getting lost. And then there's some people who are just out there to try to make money off of every change or, one particular one. And I think that it's difficult to keep track of all that. It's happening so quickly, and it's so enormously complex that we can't keep track of it ourselves. And so my hope is that, like in a book, a novel, you sort of give the reader the space to stop and slow down for a moment and be able to imagine the relationships between these macro forces and the micro, their everyday lives, because it's hard to keep track of that, I think. That was the ambition for the book, was in some ways to open that space to imagine that relationship between those two.
Well, Adam Hazlett, you talked before about writing books that you would want to read. What did you read? What are the antecedents of Union Atlantic?
Well, it's tough to find direct ones. I mean, there are things that, as a general matter, 19th century novels that inspired me, and Faulkner was the first person I fell in love with as a writer. So I think that concept of the past always weighing on people, which certainly it does with Charlotte here, is central, I think, to my understanding of what I'm getting at when I write. But, I occasionally would look at a book that had been about, I read Dreiser, actually has a book called The Financier, which nobody ever reads for good reason because it's terrible. But so I thought when I read that, I was like, oh, okay, well, I don't have much competition there. It's difficult to point to one or two books, on topic, so to speak.
As a writer, who are you looking for? I mean, if you're looking at someone, you're going, that's who I want to be.
I guess it's just not how my mind processes it. It's more that there are these impulses of books that I love. So I love the 19th century impulse to have that scope of, whether it's Balzac or Tolstoy or whoever, where you see the relationship between classes, you see a society operating, how the machinery works. But then my first love is always that psychic intensity of Wolf or Proust or Faulkner. And so I want to try to, have my cake and eat it too. Like I want there to be social scope and feel that I'm taking some account of what's going on in the world, but I've always got to anchor it inside someone's mind.
Part of what I was sort of driving at here is the difference between the short story and the novel. In talking to people like Laurie Moore, who's basically a short story writer, and her novel, the one I read, while beautifully written, doesn't seem to quite work for me.
Right.
Trying to figure out how come Adam Hazlett's book does.
Uh-huh. Well, one of the interesting things, actually, is that people have said to me, oh, you know, it's a real page-turner. And I was like, really? I mean, because of course, I have no objectivity, and I don't know that I've ever sat down and read the entire thing front to back, just, you know, with any kind of distance. And so I think you always write, as a writer, you often write against what you think of as your own weaknesses. And I think I've always thought that maybe plot was a weakness in a sense. And so I think the result is that I've actually wound up with a book with a fair amount of plot in it. I thought a lot about the difference between short stories and novels, and I knew I didn't want to write a novel that was a short story with a lot of air pumped into it. That, you know, I actually wanted to kind of try to work in a different mode.
Well, what struck me, particularly in the chapter with Glenda, the wife, is that suddenly out of the blue we've got a new character. We're invested in the plot. We don't know who she is, and she's planning a party.
Yeah.
Right? So you keep reading, and then suddenly, wham.
I mean, that's the other thing that's just satisfying about novel writing, which I think was, by the time I finished the stories, I was ready to do, which is that you can enjoy yourself at a greater length in certain things that just kind of interest you rhetorically or whatever it is, and those can be tied in. Whereas, you know, I think the good short story writer is always asking, is this sentence necessary? And if it's not, it's got to be cut.
Adam Hazlett, why did you choose the name Union Atlantic?
It was first called First Atlantic, and then we found out there was a bank by that name. It was a hard book to title because, as you mentioned, there are four characters who each sort of jockey for centrality in the book, and, you know, only one of them works at Union Atlantic. But there's somehow that, at least they're all in some orbit in relation to it, and so it just seemed like it solved the problem of having to have a weighty, literary, meaningful title.
Well, the title of the first book is You Are Not a Stranger Here, which is not the title of any of the stories.
No. I'm an old New Order fan, and I always loved how they titled their albums a title that was not one of the titles of the songs. So I found a phrase that I thought applied to the whole book. Dating myself there.
Now the book has come out. Has Hollywood come a-calling yet?
There's been interest in optioning it for a film, but, you know, I've learned to treat all that with a good deal of skepticism. If anything happens, it'll happen, but it won't be in my control.
And I understand you're writing a lot of nonfiction these days?
I've been writing some nonfiction, some short stories. I've got ideas for characters for a new novel that I've been sort of sketching out, so sort of where I always start.
Well, when you're talking about a new novel, do you have is it set in modern times?
Yeah, it would be set in modern times. I always want to know, how is it that people manage to live? And that's what I'm always trying to figure out, and so that's what I'm trying to write. So, yeah, I think it would be contemporary.
You've been listening to an interview with Adam Hazlett, whose novel is Union Atlantic. The collection of short stories is You Are Not a Stranger Here. I'm Richard Walensky on BookWaves. For more information about this show, go to bookwaves.com. BookWaves is produced by Richard Walensky in the studios of KPFA Pacifica Radio in Berkeley, California.